Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. This episode is brought to you by One Cause, creator of powerful peer-to-peer and online fundraising solutions, helping over 6,000 nonprofits make giving more social, mobile, and fun. Reinvent your supporter experience to drive deeper engagement, inspire giving, and motivate fundraising in a virtual world. To learn more about One Cause, visit them at www.onecause.com. Hi, podcast listeners. I am really excited about today's episode. This is the first in a series of conversations that we're having with AFP Toronto. I'm going to kind of hand over the reins to the team at the AFP Toronto chapter in Toronto, Canada. Teresa, you're kind of going to take the lead here. Would you mind just introducing yourself? Tell us a little bit about the chapter. What are some of the things that you all are doing up there? What's sort of different about you? And then if you don't mind, let's ask the rest of the team to introduce themselves as well.
Thanks, Jason. That's great. So I'm Teresa Vassilopoulos. I'm the executive director of the Wood Green Foundation. And I guess the big thing is about AFP is just the idea of how this chapter really sort of helps us to connect. And we're sort of experimenting with this during this COVID crisis, just to see how AFP can help us to sort of reach out and sort of connect with our colleagues during this time. So AFP Connect is available. There's also something called the AFP Global COVID-19 Resource Guide. So it's an organization that is really trying to present guides and different materials so that that people sort of going through this crisis have some resources and ways that they can ideate on, you know, fundraising during a crisis, or how do we do more digital fundraising and things like that. As well, AFP Toronto is also doing something like a virtual town hall, which is going to take place on Thursday, April the 30th from 1 to 2 p.m. And you can check out the afptoronto.org website to learn more about what they're doing. Today, what we thought was it would be really interesting to find out sort of the power of community. So we're going to be talking to a lot of the sort of frontline people that are in fundraising in Toronto during this crisis. So I'm going now to turn it over to have the rest of the group in the panel introduce themselves, and I'll start with Aaron Sanderson. Aaron?
Hi there. It's a pleasure to join you all today. My name is Aaron Sanderson. I serve as the Senior Vice President of Advancement and Chief Development Officer for Kids Help Phone, which has experienced some extraordinary increases in terms of our service delivery in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So really a pleasure to join the rest of my colleagues here.
Teresa, maybe I'll jump in next. I'm Sharon Avery. I'm the CEO of the Toronto Foundation. I'm what you might call a recovering fundraiser, 25 years of fundraising, and I'm on the funder side now, but at a highly community focused level. And so just delighted to be here to talk about fundraising and community and COVID today.
And I'm Megan Nichols, executive director at the Mississauga Food Bank. I've been the executive director 2 years there and served as the director of development for the 9 years before that. So I guess a bit of a recovering fundraiser myself. And it's fun to be on this with Aaron. I actually worked at Kids Help Phone before I came to the food bank back 11 years ago.
That's great. Thanks so much. I thought maybe we'd kick it off with a little bit of a discussion about what we're sort of seeing in our frontline organizations. So we were talking a little bit about the sort of global impact of COVID-19 and also sort of the local impact that it's having as well. So maybe I'll ask Sharon just to sort of kick off a little bit as someone from the Toronto Foundation that you sort of have a broad spectrum of all of the different organizations. Maybe just give a little bit of feedback about what you're seeing.
So it is an interesting time, and these are sort of different degrees of separation. Aaron and Teresa, I know you both worked for NGOs in the past, and the global nature of a crisis is one aspect that I think organizations are dealing with, being a part of something that is happening everywhere, as opposed to some acute shock that might be happening just locally. One might use Fort McMurray as an example in Canada and the wildfires there a few years ago. So there's this global piece, but it's a highly localized, so localized that our own families are affected. And I think one of the interesting things we might talk about at this time is how our staff are dealing with it in high-performing fundraising environments, and the pressure of both delivering for clients and the organizations and the vulnerable populations we all serve, and also the dealing with our young staff, highly female population, although not the exclusive caregivers of parents or children, but how that integration is happening. And then for me at Toronto Foundation, I'm most concerned about, my partners in crime on this call are great examples of those most vulnerable in COVID being children, vulnerable populations, newcomers, indigenous, urban indigenous, and single moms, all these sort of vulnerable populations that I'm not so much concerned about the effects of the health crisis as I am of the effects of the isolation of many of these vulnerable populations being put in even more dangerous positions because they can't be interacting with others. And so, it's a very complex crisis. I guess the last thing I'll say that we're seeing is this, the protracted nature of it and the evolving nature of it. Those of us that have worked at big NGOs in fundraising for emergencies like natural disasters, you know, these things happen. It's an event in time, and then you activate your campaigns. We're seeing a very different, almost a hesitation, except for folks in the food bank side where food security was clear. And for you, Aaron, it's absolutely clear that kids need more help and mental health support than ever. But others saying, is this an appropriate time for me to be launching things? And how challenging that is to make calls like that in an environment where the things are fast evolving, but they're also going to be dragged out for a really long time.
That's great. Maybe we will actually have Aaron talk a little bit about what you're seeing with the Kids Helpline.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to do that. And I love, Sharon, how you also spoke to how are we taking care of our people? And for us, particularly with our focus on mental health, we have to make sure that we're protecting our own staff and making sure that they're mentally well, and at the same time responding to dramatic surges in requests for support. At Kids Help Phone, about 4 weeks ago, when things really started to become serious here in Canada, we found that we had over a 350% increase in the text and call volumes coming into our service. That's thousands daily. And we saw these conversations had threads of people worrying not just about themselves or perhaps experiencing things like anxiety attacks for the first time, but also worried for their family members. You know, will my parents have a job? Will we be able to afford this? And so it was really challenging to hear those stories, but we're so thankful that we were set up in a way that our services delivered virtually, that we could scale to meet that need. At the same time, and this is a difficult thing to think about, but self-isolation and self-quarantine with your family members is wonderful if you have, you know, the space and the resources and a supporting household. Well, that's not the case for everyone across Canada. And so there have been many more reports of referrals to child welfare, for example, for children living in homes that may be with those that are their abusers. So it's a really complex time. It's not a single issue time. We're seeing folks reach out to our service maybe for the first instance, and also those that have some pre-existing mental health conditions reaching out because of the compounding effects of this current crisis. All at the same time, we have the realities that many of our fellow organizations in the sector are facing, where we had in-person fundraising events. So there's this squeeze on our resources from events and programs that maybe won't be taking place at a time when we're surging to meet 300% of our service demand. So it's difficult to balance those two things. And it's also difficult to balance those while making sure that you're not burning out, that your staff team is pivoting and adjusting to the realities of having sharing space at home, of taking care of kids that would have normally been in school. So we're doing a lot to really make sure that we're balancing that effort.
That's great. Thank you, Erin. I'm going to actually ask Megan to speak a little bit about the Mississauga Food Bank, and then I'll tell a little bit about Woodgreen, which is actually interesting because it covers a number of those different audiences as well. And then maybe we can talk about what we're seeing or what are some of the resources that are available to support some of these ideas. But Megan, maybe first just tell us a little bit about what your experience has been so far.
Yeah, for sure. So the Mississauga Food Bank is the central food bank for the city of Mississauga. So we provide food to those living in poverty through a network of 45 agencies across the city. Neighborhood food banks, breakfast clubs, after-school programs, soup kitchens, seniors programs, you know, any kind of programming for people living in poverty where there's a component of food. And I think when this really kicked off, however many weeks ago, it seems like an eternity ago, but in reality for Canada, it was really only about 6 weeks we really started kind of panicking about this. I mean, my concern right away is like, for people living in poverty, they're already living so close to the edge, either barely scraping by on minimum wage or government supports or, you know, kind of a combination of the above. So then to suddenly be told you need to stockpile 14 days of food, it's just not possible for those folks. And or in addition, you know, people losing jobs, you know, losing access to family members who may be supporting them with childcare or any of those kind of scenarios, it just kind of pushes people further to the brink. So for us, while we haven't seen, you know, it's been a little less than a 10% increase in client usage, we have seen for the very first time, a huge increase all at once in people using a food bank for the first time. So trying to help those folks who are reaching out for support and helping them navigate maybe a social services system that they haven't had to use before. And then internally, we've needed to change our practices just to meet you know, kind of the requirements now. So reducing volunteers because we need to socially distance from one another. Changing our programming a bit in terms of how we pack and distribute food so that our agencies can increase their physical distancing from people. So it's been, we talk a lot about, you know, the concept of you're building the plane while you're flying it. And this definitely has been one of those times that feels more like that than other times. And I think for the health and safety of the staff, one of the interesting conversations we've had at the leadership team is just, this is one of those times where you really see the differences between why people have chosen to do the jobs that they do. You know, for people who've chosen to work in the nonprofit sector because they have an incredible passion for the cause and this kind of feels like a calling or a mission to them, there is a sense of, you know, in times like these, you know, they're jumping in with both feet, front lines, willing to kind of personally sacrifice. But for other people, this is kind of where they landed, and especially as, you know, we have teams from fundraisers to warehouse workers. This is just a job. And so for them, the expectations to kind of personally sacrifice more, maybe more than they're anticipating. And that doesn't make it wrong. They're just approaching it from a different way. And so how do we meet the staff needs of people who will put in so much time that they'll burn out, but also meet the needs and address the fears of people for whom this is a job. And now the risks may be more than they signed up for. So I've had, it's been challenging trying to address those needs for staff.
Yeah, I completely agree. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we're seeing, Jason, on the front line at Wood Green, and then maybe some of the sort of silver linings that I'm seeing as well. So Wood Green is an organization that actually covers everything from childcare right through to elder care. So a lot of our population are isolated seniors and sort of vulnerable population, or those with mental health issues, and we also are looking at women that are fleeing abuse, or we're looking sort of caring for people that have been street involved, et cetera. So sort of a broad spectrum, and also youth aging out of foster care. So we've sort of see a big spectrum. And what we're seeing, I would say, number one, there was an immediate food crisis. So I had a greater appreciation for the work that Megan does in her program. There was a big issue around the senior helpline that we have, where there was almost a 1,000% increase in the number of calls that we were receiving from seniors, just sort of not understanding what was happening and how they would access food or different things like that. And we were also seeing a lot of anxiety in youth around around what this means and you know, how this sort of going to impact, as someone earlier said, their family and things like that. So it was really interesting, sort of the broad spectrum of things that we were seeing. We responded to sort of create our own food bank internally for the first few weeks, just so that we could get things up and going. And then we could then sort of lean on some of the programs that are existing out in the community, which has been really helpful. The interesting thing I would say is, and to me, I came into the social service sector just a couple of years ago, so I always felt it was an under the radar kind of a system, and that a lot of people didn't know what work was being done or how they could help. And I think this COVID really has amplified that it is an area that has a great deal of work in keeping the city healthy, but it probably goes under the radar and people don't realize how much effort is being at work to sort of keep people safe in their homes and out of hospitals, so that hospitals can actually focus on the very ill. So I think that was a real eye-opener, and I'm hoping that coming out of this, that there will be a greater interest from benefactors and things like that into the social service sector, and understanding how crucial that sort of frontline response is in keeping people safe in the community. The other thing I would say is that, you know, the necessity is the mother of invention, in that, you know, you're starting to see things like, you know, companies coming forward with ideas on, you know, how to create face shields, or, you know, communities coming together to make masks and things like that. So there's been a lot of, I would say, response to people understanding that there is a need in an area that they never even realized before. And so to me, that's been sort of a real positive outcome of some of this. And I think to our staff, that's been a bit of an inspiration, because they really do feel that there has been a lot of interest in championing of the people at the front line, and they're feeling very grateful.
As I'm listening to all of you talk, one of the words that I think each one of you used, if not directly, indirectly, is this notion of complexity. And I kind of wonder if everyone's sort of feeling like, when we come out on the other side of this, whatever that other side looks like, that we're all going to be a little bit more aware of the complexity of what it is we're trying to do. And maybe we're going to have this deeper understanding of, like, I think about some of the things that each one of you have just described about the people that you're serving, but also the way that we interact with our donors. There's just so much interdependency and connectedness that maybe our organizations were not aware of before. Is that true? That has to be true for everyone here.
I'd say it's true for sure. We've been running a weekly virtual gathering since the first week things really, as Megan said, that first week in March, during the March break, when we all realized this was real and it was coming at us and changing quickly. And it's been fascinating. We've had, and this is just in Toronto, about 300 people registering every week to come together and hear from the voices of the organizations on the at the grassroots who are really facing the issues. But that same group of funders and org leaders, it's a total mix of donors and funders and org leaders in that group. But they are actually contributing to each other's sense of the complexity, but also with solutions. And, you know, to Teresa's point, I think one of the things that's really heartening through this is seeing a deeper sense of community come. At least I imagine, Megan, you're seeing it in Mississauga from a Toronto environment. And Aaron, you would see it across the country. And I know you guys have made a big call for volunteers. And I think you've had a pretty good response. And I'm just curious if you have, because I think we're all hoping that what people are learning from this is how complex inequality is. And it's playing out for us in a really wide variety of ways, but also people are sort of feeling the urge to step into it in a way that we haven't seen, donor patterns being over the years. 66% of all donations in Canada go to only 1% of the charities, and they are not anybody on this call.
I have to agree with you, Sharon. Sorry about that, Aaron. Yeah, go for it.
I have to agree with you, Sharon, just in the connectedness. And I have to say, it's also, I think, spawned some interesting ways for collaboration that maybe didn't exist before. And so I love your comments around coming together to create new solutions between the funders and leaders. We've, for example, just launched a really, I think, important partnership with Boys and Girls Clubs nationally. Like, all of these young people have had most of their programming closed down, but we all recognize that they still need support. So we banded together to make sure that our service was offered and promoted to those young people when they were looking for answers. And we did that through the Boys and Girls Clubs. So this is new territory for us. It sounds simple, but it's a really wonderful example of how our organizations can approach this work differently and in such a unique and unknown time. At the same point, you're right, we did put out a call for additional volunteer crisis responders in Canada. We've had about 6,000 people submit an application, so not even visit the site to learn more, but submit an application to say they would go through 36 hours of online training to become a volunteer crisis responder. So it's a high bar activity for these people to commit to. We ask them to commit to a year because we're expecting that the mental health implications of this current time are actually going to have a really long tail to it, as families may have additional struggles even later on when the economy starts to open up again. So it's just overwhelming to see this all take place. And at the core, I truly believe that Canadians are incredibly generous. They are looking for something to do that is within their control to contribute to resolving this terrible situation. And I see we're seeing just remarkable ways of them coming together from coast to coast to coast.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think
we've seen the same thing on the volunteer front. We've had an incredible number of people reach out and want to come volunteer with us, to the point where, you know, we've had to kind of turn some forms off on our website and things like that, just because we've been overwhelmed with inquiries. And I think you're right. People really, they want to give back. And I think as people are recognizing, you know, someone who's running a campaign for us said, you know, for some people, this is an inconvenience, but for others, it's a crisis. And because it's being almost universally experienced to whatever degree, people are like, oh man, you know, I'm having to think a lot about going to the grocery store. Imagine if I also didn't have enough money to do it. They're thinking, oh man, I'm really struggling with my kids at home. Imagine if we also had XYZ challenges. And so I think the universality of it, if that's a word, is, you know, encouraging people to think about how other people are dealing with this and recognizing the challenges in it. And I'm hoping that that's a lasting impact from this.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Megan, about that. What I also was thinking was, you know, this whole idea, even about the podcast that AFP is doing and trying to bring us together and get some of these discussions going. I mean, you're seeing more and more of that, that people are trying to get connected to each other and stay connected. And I think, you know, some of the ideas of how do you even fundraise in sort of this situation. You really do have a real critical need. You want to balance that with what everybody's feeling and this sort of unprecedented kind of, you know, time that we're in, and sort of be sensitive to the fact that people are dealing with their own issues in their own home. And then how do you sort of get them to also pay attention to something that is so critical at the front line? So I think the whole idea of these kind of things that AFP is doing will really sort of help to, you know, continue to open these conversations and get some of these discussions going. So I'm looking forward to their town hall and sort of to see how more people are sharing this and the rest of this pod series on hearing from all the different sectors within the fundraising industry.
Teresa, can I add something? Sorry.
I'm very curious to hear, as sort of the onlooker who sort of gets to look and listen to all this, and I'm going to get the benefit as will all of our listeners to sort of listen to these conversations. How is this going to change each one of you and how you look differently at your work? Because I have to imagine that in the last 4 to 6 weeks, we've all been sort of shaken up and punched in the gut and thrown a few curveballs, but we're going to be different people on the other side of this. Who are we going to be?
It's an interesting question. I think this has been a really interesting, I've heard so many of my colleagues say there's no rule book for leading through a time like this. And I think, so personally, I think that the difficult thing for me as a leader in this has been all the communication that one has to do. And you already get the sense that I have no trouble communicating, but it is the sort of the tiring process of learning how to communicate virtually. But at the same time, how we've learned how little travel we really need to do, you know, this idea that every job it has to be in the office is now gone, and how much more flexible I think we should be as a sector. And then you've heard echoes of all these partnerships. I have to just do a shout out to Imagine Canada. And here in Ontario, the Ontario Not-for-Profit Network, and what an amazing job they've done mobilizing the sector with government. Because I think the last thing I would say in terms of what I'm going to look at as a leader in the sector is I'm starting to realize the true power of government relations and how invisible the sector has been at the federal level and to a certain extent at the provincial level as well. And how much more power we have when we unite our voices clearly and push to be recognized as 11% of the GDP in this country.
Yeah. And I guess from my point of view, coming out the other side, I mean, there's two things I sort of have taken away from this. One is that I'm really hoping that there will be a much greater recognition of the sort of front line. I had worked in healthcare before and so understood that front line, but didn't even realize this sort of even more invisible front line of the social service sector. So I'm hoping that that I can help be an advocate to sort of, you know, really continue to move that topic forward. The other thing that I'm really interested in is sort of how it's going to affect our youth. You know, we talk about the millennials and their sort of interest in fundraising and volunteerism and things like that. And having kids in that sort of age group myself, I'm really fascinated on how that's going to impact this group, because they've already been through a number of sort of global issues that have happened. And this is just one more, but this one is something that's so very personal. It's really affecting them and disrupting their lives in a way that it's never happened before. And it's not a short-term thing. It's a longer-term thing. So I'm curious, because I think there's so much power in that group and how strong an advocate group they can be, that I'm sort of interested to find out what'll happen with them.
Yeah, especially as an organization that's not a government-funded organization, it's interesting how early on in the cycles of funding that have emerged, you know, that food banks were included in something that during a time of crisis is considered,
you know, urgent and mandatory, and apparently the rest of the time not on that list. So I am hoping to be able to continue the dialogue with local government leaders as well to, you know, talk about the urgent needs that people living in poverty have.
Yeah, and just to that point, you know, if we were having this conversation 10 years ago, a mental health organization wouldn't be on a panel that's frontline. So we've seen some of these changes, I think, take place over time. And it's wonderful to see how the community has responded. Even government has responded generously to the charitable sector. Sharon, I love your comments about us asserting our place as a substantial part of what makes this country function and excel. So I think we need to keep more of that. You know, maybe we can shed a little bit of sheepishness about our advocacy for our causes. And there were some other comments about, you know, keeping the good habits that come out of this, connecting with people virtually. You know, it's embarrassing to say, but I'll admit, I have staff in almost every province across the country. And when we would do our monthly advancement team calls, we were videoing them in. It was just a regular dial-in. And so now everyone is videoing in, and they've told me, staff have reached out independently to say how wonderful and how much more connected they feel now than they did before. So that's a habit that we're going to keep. It's a small example, but I wonder how many other great habits we can form during this time that will just make our sector better when we come out the other side of this.
That's true. I've really enjoyed connecting with colleagues that are doing similar work to mine in other provinces. And especially, like you said, by video, it's been a great way to get to know people and, you know, have an opportunity to kind of laugh together and commiserate a little bit, and has brought, you know, you're right, a little bit more humanity to a call than you have just on the phone. So that collaboration, I think, is a good habit that hopefully we can continue with. I think it's one of those things that we all, you know, if you'd asked me a year ago, you know, would you like to collaborate with sector leaders more? I'm obviously going to say yes. It's one of those challenges for in terms of carving out the time to do it. And in the midst of this, we've recognized it. We have to carve out the time to do it. We won't be able to achieve our missions without collaborating with others. And so I think having experienced the benefit in these times, it'll be great when we can continue to apply those in the months to come.
Well, Jason, over to you. I think if we're going to keep speaking for a little while, do we want to talk a little bit about the innovation that we're seeing in the field? I don't know if anybody else has been seeing some of that, but that's been, I think, one of the big benefits that have come out of this as well.
Yeah, I'd love to hear some great examples of that.
I mean, it's interesting. We've had a couple of people come forward with like 3D printer ideas on how to make face shields for some of the PSWs that are going into some of the nursing residents or homes and things like that. And so they're starting their own sort of network of, you know, sort of a call out to everybody else in the industry that has 3D printers to come together and do that. And then you saw some of the hockey companies that have been coming forward with shields and things like that. I was reading this morning about some collaboration from two of the sort of competing drug companies on how to make a vaccine and work together. So to me, it's been interesting to see how, as I said before, like necessity has sort of driven a bit of this innovation, but it's really interesting. And then from a much more local sort of grassroots thing, this whole idea of the masks and making the masks at home, and you know, we're having some of our seniors do it as an activity that they can do in isolation. So it's all very interesting how much of that is happening within the sector, and also fundraising ideas.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say, I also see a lot of blurring of the lines and a lot more flexibility. And so even things like organizations that wouldn't be seen as traditional charities stepping into a real social purpose environment, again, I think that could be a silver lining that comes out the other side of this in terms of expanding people's sense of what their role in society is and isn't. But also just the, even within our workplaces, I don't know about you guys, but I've had so many opportunities through this crisis to move staff into different positions. And you see that translate externally with newcomers being invited even without the sort of formalized Canadian credentials, to be stepping into healthcare and long-term care homes and things like that. I think that it's given us a permission not only to innovate, but to rule break, which is one of my favorite states, because I think we should be challenging the status quo, right? In a crisis, otherwise you wasted the opportunity to do things differently.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap this up, we're going to do this series with a number of the a number of groups in the Toronto chapter, and I'm curious, what are you all at sort of the forefront of this series of conversations interested in hearing from the rest of those groups? Because they're all probably going to jump on here and listen to this and sort of figure out, okay, how does this work? What types of things would you like to hear them talking about as we sort of wrap this up?
I think for me, the part about what happens coming out the other end. I mean, I think right now everybody's in a bit of crisis mode and all of us are doing our best to, you know, ensure that we're doing the best possible service. But what are some of the lessons coming out of this? How can we change as an industry, as a society? I think that's what is really going to be interesting. And I think, like Sharon said, the rule breaking, like what were we able to achieve? What did this crisis teach us all?
Yeah, I think I would say the same thing. You know, what are the things we've had to do differently because of circumstance that we realize are actually better ways to do it? Faster, quicker, more efficient, or on the opposite end, more human, more focused on end user, more results driven, that we wouldn't have, you know, kind of come up with without having this time of crisis, and collaborations we wouldn't have had if we weren't kind of, you know, thrown in to be working together. And there's been a number of times my staff and I have said, you know, we're doing this different. I hope this sticks. And I'm looking forward to hearing from others on this series, things that they also are hoping that stick as they move ahead.
I'm also curious about...
I'm picturing a rule breaker. Oh, sorry, Aaron. Go ahead, Aaron.
I'm curious, just because we're here assembled with AFP, and I've been involved. In fact, I was chairing Fundraising Day, which, of course, is not going ahead as planned in early June, but we will reboot that for next year. But I'm curious about what people will, going through this, what they want from the community of practitioners around them. Where's the value that they need to have from their local chapter? I think this will be a really great moment of sort of introspection for us as a community to decide what's the content, what's the learning, what's the connection that's the most valuable. And potentially it's through other virtual platforms like this podcast series.
And I'll just add one last idea to coming out of this series could be the fundraisers rule breaking book. And in a, you know, in a sector that knows it needs to continue to change and evolve, I think that a really positive thing that would come out of this is a real statement from the sector about how it's going to change as a result, and everything everyone's already said, but make it fun, make it clear, make it specific, and really really evolve as a sector through this.
Yeah, Sharon, I have to, you and I don't know each other at all, but you're talking to a guy who loves to break rules, and I think that's what we're trying to do here. yeah, that's really exciting. Teresa, as we wrap this up, what's the way anyone who's listening to this, whether they're in Canada, locally in Toronto, or if they're anywhere on the planet and they want to reach out to you or a member of this group, what's the way that you would suggest that they do that?
I think probably the best is for them to go through afptoronto.org, because then they can sort of connect with all of us that were on this podcast and can tell them more about the podcast series that's going to be going forward, and also all of the other resources that that are available to them. So I think that would probably be where I would direct everybody.
Okay. I am delighted that you all were on here today with us to kick this particular series off. Thank you to Ender and the rest of the team at AFP Toronto for collaborating with our podcast to make this happen. And we look forward to continuing this series here in the next couple of days. If any of you would like to be back on here, have a conversation, have a big idea or a bold opinion about the fundraising profession, you're always welcome.
Thanks so much, Jason.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jason.
Everybody.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.